This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. Sunday, April 11th, will be the 40th anniversary of the disappearance of Williston's Barbara Louise Cotton. She was 15 years old when she was last seen, and an investigation failed to solve her mystery. James Woolner is the creator and host of the Dakota Spotlight podcast. The Cotton case is the focus of his fifth season. Woolner's investigation turned up the sisters of a person of interest, and the sisters implicate their brother. Today, Ashley Thornburg visits Woolner and Cotton's childhood friend, Sandy Evanson.
Sandy, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
James, thank you for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Sandy, I want to start with you because so much of this centers on loss, and this person was your friend.
Yep.
What was Barbara like when you two were playing together in your childhood and early teens?
She was very quiet. She was very honest. She was very loyal. Mm-hmm. She was very pretty. She was fun. We would laugh and talk for hours. We'd spend all day together and never fight.
Mm-hmm.
She was just a very wonderful person. Just beautiful inside and out.
James, what drew you to the story of Barbara Louise Cotton's disappearance at just 15 years old?
It's kind of interesting. So it was on my radar maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and I emailed a retired detective. He said, you know, because it is an ongoing case, he did not want to talk about it. But okay, he suggested I talk to the Williston PD, reached out to them, didn't get any response. And then I just put it on the back burner. And I went up to Williston, wasn't that long ago. It was the day I met Sandy in Recreation Park there in January of this year. And I thought I was just going to maybe do a one episode thing, you know, and maybe even talk about a different case and just try to find Barbara's, you know, I'd read about her walking home. I didn't know anything about it. Kind of went up there to just do a little story. And between, you know, Sandy's interviews and, you know, access to the family, interviews with Barbara's siblings, all of a sudden, it became much bigger than I expected. But I guess what drew me to it initially is it's just always, you know, a missing person, 40 years and very little information. I don't know. I guess I just wanted to try to find out as much as I could more about Barbara, I guess. I didn't have any thought that we're going to maybe try have any realistic chance of finding real answers. But once I got into it more, all of a sudden it just, you know, the community up there just come out of the woodwork and people want answers.
Yeah. 4 decades of little information that she's never been found or heard from again since April of 1981. Sandy, as someone who lost a dear friend in a very, very tender age, and then 40 years goes by, and I'm wondering, how do you keep up, I don't know if hope is the right word. I guess I should start with that. Do you keep up hope that you will still find Barbara alive?
No, not alive.
So what are you hoping for at this point?
We find her and bring her home. That is one thing I'd really love to do, but that one's even hard to keep hope after 40 years. But Barb would have came home if she was alive. A couple people have made the suggestion, you know, what if she had amnesia and that'd be the only way that I could ever see it happening. She would never have been gone from her family or her friends without no call this long. And as you probably recall, that she was supposed to be in a wedding with Diane Lattiser. Mm-hmm. And she would have never left Diane. That's not the kind of person Barb was. She would have never left her hanging like that.
Yeah.
So hope that she's alive. Not so much. Not at all, really. And I felt that early on. I can remember feeling that early on, that this was bad. And that she wasn't a runaway. And that she probably wasn't coming home in a good way.
Yeah. In the podcast, you talk about people who put out this theory that, you know, she's 15 years old, she's fighting with her mom, there might be a boyfriend who travels a lot, and people do put out the idea that she's a runaway, and you never thought that.
I feel like that came from the police department, you know, more than anything, but Louise seeing them together that night, like that's her first tip. And a lot of people get stuck on the word boyfriend, but at that time we would say boyfriend for just a friend that was a boy. And so, but then he's the last person, so did Barb just take off with him and you know, had plans on coming home the next night or something, is what Louise is thinking, and then now she's too scared to. And so she's giving the police these tips, and that, you know, that's kind of the thought that I get from what I remember of Louise telling me and also telling my mom about that incident.
James, you said right away that you thought you might do one episode on Barbara Louise Cotton, and then early on in the podcast, you call it a five-part series. At the time of this recording, and we're talking on Saturday, I think it's March 27th, yes, at the time of this recording, there are 8 episodes, and it ends on a bit of a cliffhanger and a promise for more, and before we started recording, you said you have enough for at least one more, maybe even 2 or 3 more episodes. When did you really get the sense that this story had so much more than just 1 hour of content or one episode anyway?
I guess it was when I interviewed the family, and there was some very, I don't know the right word to use, but it was strange for me that, you know, Barbara's siblings were not aware of some of the details that I had heard from other places, you know, and we've learned more of that along the way. So there was this sense of Mrs. Cotton either not sharing all the information with her kids or just simply trying to protect them, right? Like, it's not necessarily something suspicious, but, you know, I had more and more questions as things came along. And then, you know, after episode 3 came out, Williston PD reached out to me, you know, 4 times in one day, I think, 2 emails and 2 calls, and they wanted to be involved. And that's when I got the interview with Williston PD, which is episode 6, and that opened up even more information. So I'm not sure exactly when I realized it, but, and another contributing factor was the way the community has really, the community of Williston has really, you know, come out, and, you know, my Facebook group grew from, I think, 550 members to 2,600 in a couple, 3 weeks. You know, mostly people in the Williston area. And, you know, and now we have 3 persons of interest, basically. And, you know, my interview with Williston PD, they told us about one. So the next episode will be about one of these persons of interest. And then I know I'm going to do an episode leading into the 40th anniversary, which is April 11th. And then at least one, I don't know how many more episodes after that. Thinking about possibly doing a kind of panel episode where different 4 or 5 people get to discuss the case and their thoughts on it. So,
yeah. Sandy, I'm curious, are you on that Facebook page?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What's it like after all these years to have this dedication of interest to this project? And okay, it's one thing to be active on a Facebook page, but are people talking about this at, you know, at the corner of, you know, Main and First or in Recreation Park?
Yeah. It's it's been the talk of the town, and it's a double-edged sword because I wanted to hear all these things for so long, but then when you hear them and you think about, like, I've gotten not only through the Facebook page, but personally people have reached out to me on Messenger or personally called my phone and sent me rumors that they've heard or tips that supposedly were given to the FBI or different scenarios of what happened to her that night. And I remember when I got the first one, I think I hadn't even listened to the podcast yet. I was at work. Mm-hmm. And I got a message saying that Barb had been raped and murdered and put in the basement and covered up when they poured the foundation. Mm-hmm. And I about broke down at work. And I was like, you know, I don't want to hear this, but yes, I do. I want to hear every last thing because who knows which little bit of information will be that one that leads to finding her. So that has been a double-edged sword. And then, like, I've teased James, like, he's broke my phone. I swear sometimes it's smoking because of all the people reaching out to me. I have to restart my phone all the time now.
Wow. Did you anticipate this, James, when you started this podcast?
Oh, absolutely not. No. You know, I did not. It's been a pretty big surprise. I mean, it's been great, actually, as far as, you know, feeling the support. I keep waiting for the haters to arrive, you know, in the whole climate we've had in this country for so many years now. You know, I'm waiting for the people to show up on the Facebook group or elsewhere and say, you know, there's always there's always strong criticism, right? And, you know, this week, twice during these however many weeks now, I've told people through Facebook that, you know, I'm wiped out. I need to step away for a few days. And ordinarily, you know, content providers are not given that kind of slack, right? But these, you know, like they don't care. Well, we want more, you know, usually. Mm-hmm. But the support on this group has been incredible. They're like, you know, commenting in the face, take some time, rest up. You know, we're eager to hear the next thing, but, you know, take care of yourself. And so I guess the big surprise for me is it's been a while since I've seen a group. You know, obviously this group is like any other slice of Americana, diverse political opinions and all that, but there's none of that going on in this group so far. And that's been the surprise to me, is that it's been a while since I felt some kind of just, turns out, doesn't matter what your political opinions are, but people want to find out what happened to a 15-year-old girl who went missing 40 years ago.
We're visiting with James Wallner. He is the creator and host of the Dakota Spotlight podcast. Season 5 centers on the 40-year-old mystery surrounding the disappearance of 15-year-old Barbara Louise Cotton, who was last seen in April 1981 in Williston. We're also visiting with childhood friend of Barbara's, Sandy Evanson. And James, you talk about, you know, telling this Facebook group that you need a break, but you're also mentioning that in the podcast. There's sort of this, you know, Wizard of Oz peeking behind the curtain of how things work in this podcast production, where you say, like, okay, we're going to take a break. We want to digest this. And you're talking about how frustrated you are that certain leads, you know, go nowhere, as is always the case in a murder mystery or in any kind of mystery. Why did you want to include that sort of peek behind the curtains aspect?
I'm not exactly sure, but I am aware that at some point along the process, I don't even think it was in episode one, I stopped saying you know, I want to find out. And at some point I started saying we. I kind of feel like myself, even though I'm the one behind the microphone, I do feel like it's this, you know, group, a big group of people who want answers. And it sort of didn't feel right to exclude them from the behind the scenes stuff, I guess, you know.
That peek behind the curtain has been how I've felt. is like I'm getting a peek, you know, talking to James so much or whatever and stuff. I'll want more of a peek behind the curtain because I know he's got things in his head that I don't know yet or ways that he found them and stuff. And he's enlightened us a little bit into that, but there's no way unless we were really there 24/7. Like, how did you find that librarian, which I thought was great? Or how did you, like now on the Facebook page, he's saying that he found the suicide note. And these are things that we have been, like, waiting for so long. I feel like I'm in Oz now finally and getting some of these answers, and I'm looking to that guy back there and want to know how he's doing it.
Well, I wonder, James, has the Williston PD talked to you at all about just the differences in detective work, the major advances that have happened between 1981 and now? You have the advantage, James, of having the ability to reach out to lots of people very easily on social media. And now, of course, the police have lots of advances in DNA. Have you guys talked about just how this change in technology might help the case?
Detective Hendricks at Williston PD did state that she thought it was, you know, a great platform, a podcast, and they were excited about the opportunity to reach, you know, a lot more people. For example, you know, they have these three persons of interest, and through the podcast, I'm able to tell listeners, you know, this is what Williston PD would like to learn more about this individual and so on. Regarding their advancement in technology, we haven't had a lot of discussion. Maybe that because there's no crime scene that I'm aware of.
Sure.
You know, was the whole forensic thing. When you don't even know if she's, you know, like Sandy says, I don't think she's alive either, but there's no body, there's no anything. And, you know, obviously detective work has changed a lot since 1981. We haven't had a lot of discussions about it, actually.
Do you ever kind of wonder about being, you know, like the armchair quarterback, the Monday morning quarterback of detective work here? Like, you're doing a lot of cool things, James, but, I mean, is it actual police work?
Well, I don't know. I guess you'd have to ask. You know, I said, after my interview with Williston PD, I said, you know, they want to learn more about, they named these three persons of interest. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one interesting thing to know would be, can anyone place Frank De La Pena, who is one of these persons of interest, with mm-hmm. Barbara Cotton or the other one? Mm-hmm. So I asked Williston PD, well, if you have a mugshot of him, I can get that picture out to thousands of people. And who knows, you know, it's a long shot. Maybe someone will say, you know what, I remember that guy. And they were going to look for a photo. They never sent me a photo. So I called to Colorado, where he was arrested, made an open records request, got the photo from them, and posted it on, you know, the Facebook page. To me, that's, I don't know if you'd call it police work, but it's administration around getting the word out. So,
yeah. Well, it's fascinating to me, James, how much of your life has become teaching yourself these incredible skill sets that most people have to go to school for a pretty long time for, between, you know, creative writing, storytelling, and journalism, and the ethics of certain types of journalism, and then also this police work, too. Have you always been that kind of, I'm just a curious guy and I'm going to turn over this rock just to see what's under it kind of mindset?
I think so. And without getting too personal about my personal life, I'll just say that if a person has been in an environment where they didn't feel like they were getting straight answers a lot in their lifetime, you kind of adopt an innate sense of understanding when there's something missing from the story, or maybe you're being lied to, or so. I've basically spent my life trying to put pieces of a puzzle together. And I've always just been very curious and, you know, I like crossing my T's and dotting my I's, getting the full story. I often joke, I don't know if it's a joke, that I'm a pretty literal person, and I think I can be kind of a pain to some friend, you know, just in social situations where I might get a little too bogged down on the wording sometimes, even if you're just sitting around having a beer, people trying to have a good time. I'm like, wait, well, what did you say? What does that mean? So, yeah, probably always been this way.
James, just to talk about just briefly sort of the business of podcasting, there is so much. There are dozens, probably hundreds of hours that you have put in to researching and writing, and the production values on this are really quite high.
Thank you.
Are you able to make money doing this podcast kind of on your own? I mean, I know you have the partnership with Forum Communications now, or what's kind of your goal of doing this from a business perspective?
Well, from a business perspective, it's not really to make money. I mean, I was overjoyed when I was able to quit my day job. So I have a background in IT. I was a web and database developer, or still am, really. But so I moved from the IT industry, and Forum Communications has me under their belt now. So I am able to do this full time. And for me, that is sort of the reward. I mean, as you probably know, Ashley, journalism doesn't pay as well as IT, but it's more, this is very rewarding for me. And I don't have any huge goals as far as a business. I mean, there's, I don't know how many thousand true crime podcasts there are out there. I sometimes I say it's almost become a cliche, and I don't know how much longer I'll be doing it, to be honest. I mean, I'm kind of a type of person that takes on different projects and adventures. So, you know, obviously, like anyone, I'd like to reach a bigger audience, of course. But I don't have any huge long-term goals set. You know, this, I'm just very happy with this story about Barbara Cotton. You know, I said season two about the double homicide down in Zealand in 1976, I thought, I wonder if anything will top this sort of as being personally rewarding for me. And this one is definitely there with Barbara. This has just been a very rewarding ride for me personally also.
Sandy, when you hear something like that where you know how much effort James had put into a podcast like this and doing it without hope of, you know, large financial contributions, and I just wonder, how do you feel about this interest in Barbara, and maybe more importantly, what do you think Barbara's reaction would be to this kind of community coming together and still thinking about her?
I think she would be overwhelmed, and I'm overwhelmed, and I'm very grateful to James that, like, he could have came in and just did one episode, and that's kind of the things that have been done so far. You know, when it came to articles in the paper, it'd be one article or something, and not really like a continuing series of asking questions and getting answers, them either writing it off or keeping it on the books or and going on to the next lead. And he just, I keep thinking, when's he going to be done? And I'm going to be really sad when he's done, but he's not done. And I joke about it. You're never going to be done. And pretty soon there's a book coming. But he just keeps finding more information and more information. It just blows my mind.
Sandy, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure.
James, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much for having me back. Appreciate it, Ashley.
That was Dakota Spotlight podcast creator and host James Woolner and Barbara Cotton's childhood friend, Sandy Evanson. You can listen to the podcast at dakotaspotlight.com. On Sunday, family and friends will mark the anniversary of the disappearance at Williston's Recreation Park from 2 to 6 p.m. Coming up on Main Street, a discussion about sexual harassment in the workplace. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Legislative leaders had hoped they would know the guidelines for spending the new federal COVID relief money to deal with it this session, but they say that's unlikely. North Dakota is set to receive around $1.3 billion from the American Rescue Act. Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner of Dickinson says lawmakers will be back in December for a redistricting session, and they'll be able to make decisions on spending that money at that time.
Right now, it looks like we're going to probably have our Appropriations Committee stay intact during the interim. And they are part of the budget section anyway. It's nothing really major. And that they would work during the interim on these budget issues with the federal dollars so that when we get to redistricting, we have got a plan and we know what the guidelines are.
Wardner says he would still like to save as many days as possible for the December session. He says there is an informal target date of April 23rd for adjourning the regular session. The state Senate has turned down a bill that would have required the legislature's budget section to approve or reject the bid for providing health insurance for state employees. The Public Employees Retirement Systems Board makes that choice, and Valley City Republican Senator Mike Wabama said this would set up a constitutional problem.
As this body already knows, the legislature is to create legislation and provide the appropriation to fund that legislation. The executive is tasked with executing the requirements of said legislation and appropriation. What this bill does, then, is insert the legislature into the executive responsibility of executing the tasks related to determining which health care coverage to select.
The measure failed 35-12. And optimism and farming often go hand in hand, but the dry conditions we are experiencing this spring might be tempering that a bit. Erica Olson is a market development and research manager with the North Dakota Wheat Commission. She says when it comes to concerns over drought, it depends on who you talk to.
I think these dry conditions are becoming very concerning for producers, and again, specifically as you get in that western half of the state.
Olson says the dry weather arrived just as growers were seeing good price movement for all commodities. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Sexual harassment in the workplace is a problem for the victim, the accused, and the business. These days, many businesses offer training to managers and employees to avoid costly legal confrontations. At Prairie Public, we're required to take online training. Today, we'll share a conversation about the issue between Fargo attorney Lisa Edison Smith and Prairie Public's John Harris, host of the weekly Prairie Pulse television show.
Lisa, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Your specialty is workforce harassment. What got you involved in that?
Well, when I went to law school, it was a particularly pivotal area in labor and employment law. There were a lot of cases before the Supreme Court about sexual harassment, and that was always my interest in practicing law. So I have always practiced employment and labor law, primarily on the management side, since I came to the Vogel firm.
And we're probably going to talk a lot about sexual harassment, but is there a legal definition for that?
Sexual harassment is a form of sex discrimination. Sex discrimination is prohibited by both federal and state law. And it wasn't until actually 1986 that the U.S. Supreme Court recognized that sexual harassment was a form of sexual discrimination, which can come in the form of sexual comments or other kinds of abusive or harassing behavior directed at individuals in the workplace based on sex. Sexual harassment doesn't need to be overtly sexual. It doesn't need to be proposals or jokes, but it needs to be abusive and harassing behavior in the workplace that creates a severe or pervasive atmosphere of harassment based on sex.
It's pretty complex.
It is, and the line drawing in sexual harassment is extremely hard to do because courts struggle with that. What's severe or pervasive? When does a casual joke cross that line over into something that's potentially violative of the sexual harassment laws?
What's the difference in, harassment, workplace harassment, and a hostile work environment?
Well, there are essentially two forms of sexual harassment, and hostile work environment is one form of sexual harassment. There are two types of harassment. One is the Latin phrase quid pro quo, and that's what you think of the old Mad Men style boss chasing the assistant around the desk. That's either you have a relationship with me or you'll either be terminated or it will hurt your career. So that's something for something. You have the relationship and you'll do well or you'll be terminated. Hostile work environment is different. Hostile work environment doesn't necessarily involve requests for sex or for sexual behavior, but it involves abusive conduct, maybe jokes. We see in this electronic era screensavers, all sorts of messages, and maybe Facebook posts, things that are shared in the workplace. It could be any kind of that behavior that's derogatory and directed at one sex based on their sex. That has to have a substantial impact on the workplace in order to be actionable under the statutes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, right now and in the news a lot with the New York Governor Cuomo's allegations, North Dakota legislature Luke Simon was expelled from the state legislature. Can you talk about maybe those two cases from your perspective?
Well, I don't have all of the details of them, so I can't comment on the specifics of them. When it comes to Governor Cuomo, I view the Governor Cuomo case as sort of an extension of what we've seen happening since the Me Too movement really in 2017 began. An individual in a position of power who is alleged to have abused that power both by making comments of a sexual nature, by inappropriate personal comments, and by just out-and-out sexual conduct towards junior staffers. With Representative Simons, it's a little bit more complex, as I understand it, in that there's not the element of request for sexual favors, but there's derogatory comments, suggestive comments towards women, and comments that, for example, suggest women belong in a particular role that are derogatory towards women in general.
When did companies start to take this issue seriously?
Well, that really is a question that depends on who you talk to, because there are a significant number of people who say companies aren't taking it seriously right now. But as I indicated, 1986 is the first that the U.S. Supreme Court recognized this as sexual harassment as being actionable. In the late 90s, there were a couple of Supreme Court cases that said if companies took prompt action and if they did, they took steps to have a policy and to train their employees about sexual harassment, that may be a defense to claims. And so really in the late 90s is when you started to see companies really developing those policies and developing that training. And I've been practicing law since 1996 and in Fargo since 1997. And part of my practice has always been providing training to management, to employees on sexual harassment. So it's been going on for a long time with varying degrees of success.
Mm-hmm. So do most companies have that training video or seminar for employees or not?
Larger companies, yes. Most larger companies have incorporated, you know, they have policies that are reviewed and updated annually. They're reviewed with employees and they have some form of training, live training, or many have developed computer module training updates, that online courses that employees can take on an annual basis. And that's been one of the questions, is how effective has that training really been? Because it's been around since the late 90s, and yet here we are in 2021, and we continue to see really high-profile cases. So one of the challenges to folks like us in reaching out to our clients in doing this is, what is really effective? And the EEOC, which is the federal agency that enforces sexual harassment law, has concluded that some of the canned training that employers have done, the click the button on the online training, really isn't very effective.
Hmm. Well, can you talk about some of the gray areas, or, you know, things like commenting about a new haircut or commenting about an outfit or things like that? At what point does it cross a line? And
well, the Supreme Court has said, Justice Scalia said, that Title VII, which is the law, federal law that prohibits sexual harassment, it's not intended to be a general civility code, and it's not intended to address you know, general courtesies in the workplace. So, you know, a comment I might say to you, John, that's a really nice looking tie. You look good today. That's perfectly innocuous. But the issue can be a couple of things. It can be one, the frequency. How frequent are you commenting about someone's appearance? Particularly, how frequently are you commenting about, in most cases, women's appearance? And then the other thing is tone and the specifics of the comments. A comment that might say, you know, Lisa, that's a nice looking suit you have on, or I really like those heels. Perfectly fine. But if I say it a little differently, if I say, that's a really nice looking suit, those slacks look really good on you, the intent can be different, and how it's received, which is the most important thing, by the recipient, can be very different. So frequent comments about appearance and particularly suggestive comments about particular items of wardrobe can be very problematic.
Yeah. If an employee feels like they're being harassed, what recourse do they typically have?
Most employers in North Dakota, I think, even quite small employers, have sexual harassment policies. They know that that's a risk reduction policy and it's a good thing to have. Most of the time, the first thing that an employee can do, depending on the level of severity and the level of their discomfort with it, is to try to address it with the person, you know, themselves directly, to say, I really didn't appreciate that comment. Or, you know, I don't like those jokes. If you feel comfortable doing it, that can be a first step. But sometimes you don't feel comfortable doing it just because of the nature of what the perceived threat is. Or you feel like you've done it and the conduct continues. Then most employers should have policies that say, here's the first step you would take. And it typically would be go to a human resources person if you're in an organization that is large enough to have human resources people, or go to a particular manager.
So sometimes the issues can be resolved between employees. And if they're comfortable, that may be a first step.
Absolutely. You know, policies that require employees to confront their harassers, they're not effective. And they're not looked on well by the courts in some cases. Mm-hmm. Policies that suggest, hey, you know, if you feel comfortable to address it, I've seen many cases in which what originally started out as good, you know, what people perceived as good-natured joking has escalated to a point where one or more of the parties is just not comfortable with it, but didn't feel comfortable just saying, you know, I really wish you wouldn't say that anymore. Where if the person had done that before it got to that point, it might have been effective. Not all cases, but some cases it might be effective just to say, you know, I don't appreciate that.
You know, have you seen more cases with all the media we have of Facebook, Twitter, TikToking, texting even? I mean, has it elevated because of that, or has it just always been there and it's just ways that it happens sometimes?
Well, I don't know that it's actually more frequent, but it's documented. People don't think necessarily about the fact that when you send a text message or you send a Snapchat, that person may very well have a copy of that. And there's rarely a case that I'm involved in that doesn't involve substantial either social media, private messaging, or text messaging, often photos and things of that nature. So all of us have that little computer in our pocket, in our phone, and so now it's just so much easier to capture what actually happened, and people are very casual about what they'll say and send to other people.
Mm-hmm. So, well, obviously, without getting into details or names, what are some of the examples you've had to deal with legally?
Well, you know, I think the examples run the gamut, and there's a perception, you know, perhaps that sexual harassment occurs at maybe high levels in the organization or very low levels, very educated people or very are people with limited education, and that's not the case. The reality is I've seen cases that involved males that worked in a shop, you know, blue-collar jobs, and what they claimed was an intent to be humorous, but some fairly egregious harassment of other males. Pornography, pictures, sexual comments towards other males, all the way up to presidents, CEOs of organizations trying to force unwelcome conduct on subordinates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you mentioned this, and, you know, in the past, was there sort of an anything goes attitude in some organizations?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And as some of the cases you cited, Harvey Weinstein, you know, we look at Matt Lauer. Those are sophisticated organizations. Those are powerful people. But they're people who there was a willingness to look the other way. And it's sort of, you know, there's a lot of discussion about white privilege or white male privilege. And I do think when we look at some of those more recent powerful individuals, they're not all white. There's Bill Cosby in there, too. But the power, the privilege of power is very obvious that this has continued up into 2020 and 21. Yes, it's been a problem. You have construction sites, anything goes. But you also have seen in the Me Too movement that has extended to the highest levels of corporate America and the C-suite, that powerful people have been able to get away with behavior that's unacceptable and it's unlawful.
So can you talk about or explain the importance of due process in these cases?
Due process is it's an important concept in the law, which is basically simply that an individual who's accused should have the opportunity to present his or her side of whatever and response to the allegations. And I in advising employers, that's always an important step, that the accused has the opportunity both to present their response to it and to offer up, I have witnesses and evidence on my part. And that is an important part that I always advise employers, never go simply on one side of the story. Even if you don't think there's any evidence that's going to change the outcome, you need to give that person the opportunity to be heard and present his or her side of the story.
Is there ever fear that a false allegation will ruin an employee's career and it will stick with them?
There absolutely is. In my experience, and I do a lot of training on this subject, false allegations, completely false, fabricated allegations are pretty rare. Mm-hmm. Exaggerated allegations, then you're getting into a little different territory. But I have been involved actually very early on in my career in allegations that at first blush appeared to be very serious, brought by a female against a male supervisor, that in the end there was documentary evidence that they were false. And fortunately in that case, the employer handled it well. They did a thorough investigation and were able to refute the allegations before there was public knowledge of them, so before there was that damage to a person's career. So that's always a concern. But again, my experience is truly fabricated allegations have been rare in my practice.
You know, do you find that smaller businesses deal with this less effectively than larger companies, or is it the reverse?
that's a great question, because that's contextual. In some cases, smaller businesses are better. They know their employees. They are concerned, and they're going to generally react quickly. Now, that can be a benefit. What can be a real difficulty for smaller businesses is if you have allegations, if you have a mom-and-pop run shop, and the allegation is against one of the owners of the business, who does the employee go to? And they may or may not have any outlet for employees to complain to, and employees may not feel they can complain. And in many cases, they may have inadequately developed policies or suggestions of what employees can do.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier, I mean, we think about a male employee harassing a female employee usually, or supervisor. But you said it can happen same sex, but it also can happen a female harassing a male employee. Can you explain or comment a little more on that?
Absolutely. There's Title VII, which is, again, the federal law, recognizes, and the courts have recognized, that sexual harassment can go, can be of any variety. It can be male on female. It can be female male. It can be same sex. It can be subordinate harassing a supervisor, even in some cases, although it's more typically supervisor versus harassing a subordinate. So, you know, I've dealt with all of those types of cases.
So what would your message be to companies or HR departments probably when counseling or advising them on this issue? Maybe you can give a little free legal advice today.
Well, you know, it's not particularly legal advice, because a lot of it's common sense. But common sense will be beneficial legally to employers. One, take sexual harassment and any kind of harassment very seriously. You know, have a policy. Make sure your employees are trained on that policy and update that periodically. And then take action when something happens. Take prompt action. Let your employees know that there are some teeth in those policies and that the expectations are the same from the top of the organization to the bottom. The worst situations I've been involved in is when I've been asked to do harassment training and everyone attends except upper level management. Mm. That's the worst message you can send. The message has to come from the top down.
Good advice, and we're out of time. If people want more information, where can they go?
I would suggest that they go to EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission website. They go to the North Dakota Department of Labor, Minnesota Department of Human Rights. Google any of those. Or we have a website at vogellaw.com that has many resources that address the same kind of issues.
Lisa, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Prairie Pulse host John Harris and attorney Lisa Edison Smith. You can see their entire Prairie Pulse conversation this Thursday at 8 Central on our television service. Dakota Datebook is next.
It's one thing to be insulted, but what happens when your honor is threatened?
If you have a sensitivity to threat, although you're not always walking around behaving aggressively toward people, what it takes to set you off isn't very much.
How honor culture shapes everything from barroom brawls to military valor. That's this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
The Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra is for people who treasure music and the arts. Hi, I'm Maestro Beverly Everett. We're performing our full concert schedule this season. Details are subject to change. Don't miss Game Changers, Saturday, April 17th, featuring the winners of the Young Artist Competition and the music of John Sibelius. For up-to-date concert and ticket information, visit bismarckmandansymphony.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 5th. A shocking murder gripped Ward County in the 1900s. The story played out over many years, with two trials, a false name, and a prison escape. R.S. Noah was hired in March of 1908 to work on Gus Johnson's farm near Kenmare, North Dakota. A few weeks later, neighbors began to wonder about Johnson's whereabouts after he wasn't seen for several days. Noah said Johnson had returned to Sweden, but authorities grew suspicious when Noah and another man began selling Johnson's grain. A neighbor found Johnson's body in the cellar. He had been shot in the head. On this date in 1908, newspaper readers learned that Noah and his companion had been taken to the Minot Jail to avoid a lynch mob in Kenmare. Both men were charged with first-degree murder. Noah confessed to the killing and to forging contracts that allowed him to dispose of the dead man's property. Barely 2 weeks after his confession, a jury decided Noah's punishment, death by hanging. A Minot newspaper called Noah a moral degenerate of the worst type. He smiled and even laughed in the courtroom. Noah's wife divorced him and married another man on the same day that had been set for Noah's execution. Meanwhile, Noah's companion was acquitted. Days before his scheduled hanging, in the fall of 1908, Noah's sailor brother came home from his gunboat station in China and urged the governor to issue a reprieve on the grounds of insanity. Authorities then learned that Noah had been using his brother's name the whole time. R.S. Noah was really D.M. Noah. Noah's brother filed an appeal with the state Supreme Court, successfully postponing the hanging. The court heard the appeal a year later and ordered a new trial. A Ward County jury still convicted him, but this time his sentence was life in prison. Noah worked in the prison's print shop and became a model prisoner. But after he was denied a pardon in 1918, he escaped with $25 raised by his fellow prisoners for Christmas goodies. 3 years later, he was recaptured in Kansas and returned to prison, where he was placed in solitary confinement. Today's Dakota Daybook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight...
I hate the myth of Hemingway. It obscures the man.
His talent is stunning.
She went against the grain.
It's hard to imagine a writer who hasn't been influenced by him.
In order to have something new to write, he had to have something new to live.
And he fell in love quite a few times.
He's complex and deeply flawed, but there he is.
Hemingway, the man, is much more interesting than the myth.
Hemingway, only on PBS.
Watch part one of a three-part event, Ken Burns Hemingway, tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. Tuesday on our show, we will share an encore conversation with NDSU Assistant Professor of History Donald Johnson. He's been awarded the 2021 Distinguished Book Prize in U.S. History from the Society for Military History. And a North Dakota legislator recently spoke of transgenderism as obviously unnatural. Faye Seidler is a transgender activist and co-founder of the Harbor Health Clinic. Seidler will join us to share a scientific and historical perspective on gender diversity. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.